would like to start. You know, we never know how many people are coming, and I hope that everyone can be as comfortable as possible. I do apologize for lack of chairs. We need to have more, but our neighbor moved. So we don't have as many, but I think that we can create. There's some space over here, by the way, in the hallway. There are so many new people here that who Linda and I don't know. So people should introduce themselves. And please forgive me if you told me your name and I have to ask you again. But we're so happy to see so many folks. Let me just say a couple of brief words about the salon.
I'm just sorry, I interrupt you. And see if like we can, I know it's kind of crowded in here, but maybe there's a 1, 2, 3 places to sit that actually are chairs. And if anybody wants to take up residence on the floor, please do, because I know there's people in the kitchen. It's going to be kind of hard to see in here, so please try to come in if you can.
Just a couple comments, and then we're going to start. The salon, as Linda and I choose to call it, we started about February of 2005, and it just grew out of our mutual passion for human rights issues, and we started off very small. We had a couple friends over to watch a documentary on the American Civil Rights Movement for a couple weeks called Eyes on the Prize, that very good documentary, and then something came up where, because I have been working in sex trafficking, and a friend of ours, Carol Harrington, was doing some the research in sex trafficking in Hungary. And then one thing led to another. My daughter is a filmmaker. She made a movie on date rape called No in the U.S., and we've shown that a few times, and various things have occurred. That I like to say that the strength of the salon is that Linda and I know so many fascinating people, like so many people in the room, so that it is not trying to wait till someone comes from abroad, but trying to engage got people in the room, I'm sure, to share their stories. As I like to say, everyone has a story to tell. And in that regard, that we had wanted to do something about the 1956 revolution, and we knew that there were just a million programs going on about the revolution, and so we wanted to look at it from a more human, personal experience of how it affected the lives of everyday Hungarians who were engaged in the revolution. And through our good friend Baron Weiss, we met Galinda and Gaston, and Gaston will tell you his story. So Gaston P.
Vadas.
Vadas, yes, yes.
Vodas.
Vodas, yes, okay. And like, I'm not going to say anything about his story, so I'm going to let him tell it. So just so you know, this is as much interactive as it is in presentation. People can, when it's over, feel free to stay, drink until it's gone, and just talk with folks, because I hope to be able to meet more people. Gaston.
Thank you so much. Would you forgive me if I stay seated? Is that okay? Okay. Thank you. I noticed that there is a... I'm being recorded, and it immediately reminded me of an opening, not prepared opening line, which is, "You've done nothing, you've lied, I've lied all these years." So this way, when this tape comes out, I can sound just like Gyurcsán. So you can attack me for giving you a pep talk to get off your asses and get going, and we can't do this anymore, and so on. But anyway, the reason I'm here is because I had the... I was one of 200,000 people in 1956 who left this country. In 1956, I was 12 years old. I lived in the 5th District on Vigadó tér, which then was Molotov tér. And so I left Molotov tér, and years later I came back and visited Vigadó tér. But because once again it could take its old name. But that's not the story. The amazing thing is, for me, is that over the years, images of a kid, I mean, I was 12 years old. What does a 12-year-old kid know? And you don't really realize that until you spend a lifetime being brought up a certain way in America, where we ended up, and you come back to your homeland, and you realize that the experiences that were embedded in you, the upbringing, the way of life. I was not a young kid at the age of 12. I was always out on the street because it was very safe to be out on the street for a kid. Nothing ever happened. I mean, on the way to school, I would stop, watch construction because the entire city had to be reconstructed, and I watched people work, and it was great, and every street vendor knew me, and I knew every street, and I had an incredible interest in things around me as a kid. So when I was 12 years old, and I was in something called Nopkösi, which is an extended day classroom opportunity where the kid could stay in school in the afternoon in a loose atmosphere, and they would give you some food even, and you chatted, you studied, and then by the time you got out of there, maybe your parents have gotten home from work, so you're not home alone, as we used to say after the movie came out. And this one particular day, it was a Tuesday, the only reason I know is that Linda, my wife, recently brought up the question of what day was October 23rd, and I didn't know until recently I looked it up, because that I didn't remember, but it was a Tuesday. So I was in Nopkösi, and around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:30, some kid bursts into my classroom, I mean into the school, and said, "Hey, something is happening out there. You got to see. I mean, there are all these people on the street." So, like a bullet, I'm out there because something was happening. I mean, I was bored in the Nopkösi. So my school was at the Ötvös, which is, to give you landmarks, do you like restaurants, cafes? You know where the Central Kaffeehaus is? Okay. You go a little bit further down in that street where you couldn't possibly back in or back out if you go the wrong way. That's where my school was. So I walk out onto the Kuru, they're not Kuru, Rákóczi, and I see all these people.
Kossuth Lajos,
thank you. The American corrects me. But she's right, she knows all the streets. So I go out to Kossuth Lajos utca and walk toward Erzsébet híd, toward that direction. And all these people are coming out of buildings. And it was very random, and people were talking to everybody else. And in Hungary, there is something innate about an idegen, something that's a stranger. You know, you don't talk to strangers. And most certainly, you didn't talk to people during communism if you didn't have to, because you could get yourself into trouble if you said the wrong thing. So everybody's, you know, walking around like, you know, their head down. And this was very different. Everybody was sort of chatting, and I hear things like freedom, and yeah, I was confused. I'm going with the crowd toward the Petőfi statue, which is near what is now a Marriott Hotel. You know, that's that statue that's at the foot of the bridge where the church is. And by the time I got there, there were about 500, 800, maybe 1,000 people there. And people kept coming. And as I walk onto the square, I see that Sinkovics Imre, who was probably one of the best-known Hungarian movie stars and performers, whose son actually went to my mother's kindergarten, so I knew who he was being sort of hoisted up, to the Petőfi statue. And he gets up on the statue, and there's a landing there, and by that time, there were so many people that they sort of went over the tracks of the number 2 tram, so that stopped, and things like Russians go home, and this. I mean, I was absolutely astounded. I never heard anyone openly say things like that. And then all of a sudden, Shinkovich Imre started. Talpra magyar, hívja haza, itt az idő most, vagy soha. A magyarok istenére esküszünk, esküszünk, hogy rabok tovább nem leszünk. You don't even have to know the words. You don't even have to know the words, but I'll tell you. No. We swear by our God. Basically, what he said is that we will no longer be slaves. This was the spark poem of Petőfi Sándor during the 1848 revolution. And by the time he got to the fourth or fifth stanza, everyone was also reciting. It was fabulous. It was absolutely fabulous. And when he finished, everyone just went nuts. I mean, you know, by this time there were brushes, there were little sorolap. Now I don't know in English. Leaflets, pamphlets handed out, which who knows where people ran off with little slogans about freedom and Russians go home and so on. And the word came that there were like 40, 50, 60,000 people getting together at the parliament. So I had to be there. So I start walking down up outside Cherayanoshutsa, and you know, you go past Lanshead, the chain bridge, and as we were walking along, the same thing happened from every side street that you could think of. People were just coming out of buildings, first just being curious, then the five people became 10, the 10, 20, and like a huge funnel, you know, from everywhere, were funneling into the back of the parliament there. And true, it was an incredible number of people. By this time, it was 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, started getting dusk. And by now, people are singing the hymnals, the national anthem. They're sort of getting really into it. They're demanding that the flag be taken down from the parliament with the Russian insignia in the middle. And someone wanted to hand some pamphlet to someone in the. You know, I didn't know the details. I mean, I was standing in the crowd. But you could see the activity, you could see everything happening around you, and you could hear everyone being animated, everyone talking to everyone else. And then later I found out that the reason it got so dark was they turned the lights off. Whoever it was, they pulled the plug on the lights, thinking that, you know, if the crowd is in the dark, then they go away, maybe, I don't know. But what happened was people took their newspapers, crumpled it up into a tight thing, lit the end. They took off posters from the poster board, those round border, you know, they lit the end. And if you, I can't tell you that feeling of oneness when you see, you know, by that time, close to 100,000 people, I think, or 80,000 people. I mean, it was filled. Standing there with torches, handmade torches. The word came, there are hundreds of thousands of people on Hershek Tere. Doja Gyurgyu, you know, we're at the end of Andrássy út, if you don't know it, where the huge parades used to be, and that's where the Stalin statue was, where the tribune was erected during communist events, where Rákosi Mátyás and the rest of these bastards were standing up there and saluting their own guns and own people and so on. So a number of us start walking, and the same thing happens here as happened before. As we're walking, the crowds, the little groups become bigger groups, and we're walking down the streets, and now, of course, we're chanting and asking people to come on down from the windows, join us, you know. And so we get out to about where, I guess where the museum is, Hershek Tere. And by that time, the red stars that were on the top of most buildings that were public, not public buildings, not even public, well viewable and visible buildings, that these huge red stars on them. By that time, people were on the roof, breaking these down, and they came tumbling down the street. Everywhere you could see they were taking the red stars down. And the focal point of this mass of people that was sort of going sort of down this enormous boulevard was the statue of Stalin. And by the time we got there, it was dark, but you know there was plenty of, I mean, it was enough light from the streetlights. They tried to cut off and tumble the statue, but they first tried on the base of the feet, so it didn't work. So they started working on his boots, on his knees, and the attempt failed at first because the rope snapped. Then someone with a sidecar went down to the shipyards and brought back steel cables, and they tied it to these huge these huge tow trucks, enormous, that can pick up a bus. And they had three or four of these enormous trucks tied to his neck and arms, and they managed with an acetylene torch to cut the back of the boot by his knee. And the closest I come to this image was my book on Gulliver's Travels. When Gulliver is tied down by a million ropes, you know, it's on the ground, and the Lilliputians are all over him. We were the Lilliputians. And all of a sudden, this statue starts coming forward. And the crowd just becomes still for just a second. Everyone sort of took a deep breath. And that damn statue comes, and you could hear and feel the roar, the sound, everything. It took me about 10-15 minutes to get close enough, because I was curious, close enough to see people urinate on it, kick it, punch it, spit on it. I can't tell you. I mean, the fury of the people was enormous. So now it's like 8 o'clock, and my parents don't know where the hell I am. Okay, I mean there were no phones, no mobile phones, right? So no phones, period. Forget about mobile phones. You know, we had to go to my grandmother to make a telephone call because she had a phone. Sas notes on it. Sas phones. See? Yeah. I also remember the custom reupholstery services number in New York is in Gimbel's Bigelow 40444. Anyway. Lovely. Fast back. So I go on the side street. I better start going home. So as I'm starting home, I see a siren. I hear a siren. I see an ambulance, a military ambulance. And they take this soldier out who's on the stretcher, and they bring him into this private hospital that I didn't realize was there on the Foschler. What's it? Not the Sierra Foschler, the Tier. I mean, Barashi Gati Foschler. You know that street with the Gorky. Then it was Old Gorky. Old Gorky, yes, sir. And this beautiful mansion that was a hospital for military people, which most Americans didn't know, I guess. So I said, well, what's happening? I walk up to the manager. What's happening? The shooting at the radio station. Wow. I take off toward the radio station. Well, you know, I got to see that. So by the time I get out to near, just off the off Koshutayoshitsa there, toward the radio station, I start walking into the side street, and I realize that by now people were not in the middle of the street, but people were sort of like in doorways and along the buildings, walking on the sidewalk, and I heard popping sounds. And all of a sudden, someone grabs my arm, and it's a man about 40, and he says to me, "What the hell do you? Where the hell are? Do you think you're going?" I said, "I'm going to the radio station, and they're shooting there." He says, "Yes, they are shooting there, and people are getting killed." I said, "You go home." that sort of brought me back down to earth. And I said, holy shit, you know, I mean, there are people dying. This is, I'm not that curious. So I start running home, and by the time I get to the corner of where Astoria is, that later on the Fuhrer Orban used for his, organizational meeting, there were all these barricades being put up already. Now you know what my affiliation is. And so I'm running home. Now, about an hour before that, my father asks my 8-year older brother, he was in medical school at the time, he was 6'5", "You gotta find Gaston. You gotta find Gaston." So, but he said this in Hungarian. Richie means junior. I was junior. So, my brother, knowing me pretty well, says, "Well, let's see. Where's the biggest problem? He's gonna be there." So he goes over where the museum is, and jumps across the fence. And as he lands in the bushes, he looks on the other side, just beyond the bushes. There are a bunch of soldiers setting up a submachine gun, you know, on the ground. So he goes, jumps back over the thing, and starts running home. So as both of us were running home, and there's my father, you know, waiting in the doorway, and, you know, I didn't know whether he was going to kill me or cry or whatever, and luckily, because usually if I did something wrong, he beat the shit out of my brother. So I figured my brother is in big trouble. But anyway, my father was really cool about it. He was so happy we were safe, you know, we went upstairs. And so I went upstairs, and that's when I gave my report to my family of what I had seen. This was the evening of the revolution for me. What I had found out since then, in recent years, was how it really got started. Because it, please believe me, no matter what anybody tells you, this was a spontaneous revolution. And no matter what anybody says, it was a spontaneous revolution. It did have some sparks, though, which the sparks that ignited it were based on the student organizations of Szeged, of Budapest, and some other universities, where they put out manifestos. They wanted to have meetings. Let's not get bogged down about details, because I'm sure that someone can shoot a hole in my timeline here, as they say. But the essence is that there was a spark given by the students. The government was not ready to take it really seriously. They said, "Yes, you can have a street meeting." Then they said, "No, you can't." Then they wanted to have a meeting anyway. Then they wanted, you know, and it went on like that. But these papers, these manifestos, got out on the street. They got out into, and it was spontaneous combustion. It just went like that. So that was, you know, I am not going to talk about what it was like between October 23rd and November 4th, when we basically lived in the basement to make sure that we were safe. I'd be more than happy if you want to get into details of what I saw during that period of time and what I saw after November 4th. But I do have a couple of things to say about what happened to the memory of 1956 for me. I was not emotional about 1956 all these years, but somehow 50 has something. I don't know. It was a big number. It's a half a century. So somehow I felt that a lot of people are not going to be here for the 100th anniversary of the revolution, but a lot of people are here who are here for the 50th. And for me, I wanted to feel something. I wanted to feel something special that reflected what I have just told you about, which is a spontaneous, it was a revolution. I was participating in a revolution. It was prior, I mean, I didn't end up the following days with a submachine gun or with a Molotov cocktail killing tanks and things like that. That's all part of this too. But I wanted to remember this 50th year. And what happens is that this idiotic Hungarian preoccupation with splitting the nation in half because of democracy, because we're allowed to, it hijacked. It almost, for me personally, they almost managed to hijack my memories, my ability to go out. My original plan was to go and revisit these four places and bow my head. It changed my life. It changed everything. We became refugees. We left in December. We escaped across the border with my mother. Each of us had two bags. I am one of those typical quote-unquote success stories of being a refugee, of finding a country that United States, this case, although there were many wonderful countries that did the same thing for Hungarian refugees, a country that gave me the education, the freedom to think, the freedom to become an independent individual, a country that unfortunately is changing it also, where it's taking away the freedoms, but that's another story. But it changed my, this is what gave me an opportunity to be, I think, a better, more rounded and a more intelligent individual. That's where I met my wife. How bad is that? You're still married. How many years? 37 years. Okay. So I think the way I want to finish this for the moment is that I've been writing things down, and I do want to come out with a book next year sometime of not just the story of 56, but what it was like for me to grow up in Budapest under communism, in the Rákosi period, come from a family that somehow managed to maintain civility, was lucky enough not to be evicted from the apartment. We managed to stay there even though we were not jókáder, which means if you're not the proper credentials, you could be someone who take your apartment or house or whatever, and they take you someplace with no electricity or whatever, put you in one room, and that's where you work. But at any rate, there were good things too. I have incredible memories of the summer harvest in the countryside, but the entire village in Nograd, better to say, where we used to spend summers, where how that all happened and how people there were beautiful memories of my childhood, even though it was communist era. So you can find the good. I feel that without my Hungarian base and Hungarian soul, I wouldn't be a complete person. But with my Hungarian birth and my basis and belief that America offered to me, made me a more complete person. And I feel that it's absolutely imperative that I do everything I can to make sure that in this country or in America, that true democracy is maintained, that the minority does not have a right to dictate the majority, and that there would be parliamentary procedures that are maintained, and civility. Democracy is a long, long process, and I think we must try it. We must absolutely try it, and we must insist that those people who always say no, 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 that's not right, that's not right, that they say what is right and what they are willing to agree in or with. Because I guarantee you that if you say to the other side, say, look, as bad as it looks, I'll go along with this because it's good for the nation. Okay? I bet you that they will take that. They will accept that. And vice versa. Because that's the only way that it will work. And I think we, at least, not, you don't have to do a thing. This is what I'm doing. You can only change yourself. You can only do what you can. And I want to thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions, I'll read you lullabies. Thank you very much.